Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 9th of September. Pakistan has a new president, Asif Ali Zardari, who easily won an electoral college vote, and this happened on Saturday. He declared that he will pursue the fight against the Taliban more vigorously, is seen in Pakistan as pro-American, and has been welcomed by the Bush administration for his support of the campaign against terrorism. He's the widower of the slain former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto. He was elected president on Saturday, as I said, and we'll talk about his background. There also have been missile attacks on northern Pakistan, and they have been geared toward Pakistan's most prominent Taliban leaders. We will talk about those attacks and what we can expect from a new president of Pakistan, what his background is, why Washington is excited about his being president, and what about these attacks, a couple of them in the last couple weeks. We're happy to have with us a woman who knows a great deal about this part of the world. Professor Christine Fair is senior political analyst with the RAND Corporation. Our phone number, as it always is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, or feel free, as you always can, to send us an email, and that's talk@wpr.org. Professor Christine Fair, thank you again so much for being with us.
Thank you, as always, for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. Why don't we start with a little bit of background about the new president, the husband of the former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto. What do we know about him?
Well, he is a very, he is alleged to be a very dubious and shady individual.
Mm.
He actually spent a number of years on various corruption charges. He and his supporters claimed they were politically motivated, that they were trumped up. I remember when I was a student in Pakistan in 1995, his reputation for being so unsavory resulted in a verb being coined for him. So to do a Zardari essentially meant to take 10% and graft.
Oh, my.
He was subsequently escalated to Mr. 20%.
Oh!
And now some speculate that he may yet become Mr. 30%. So he certainly has a shady past. Folks here in Washington that have not learned the lessons of putting all of their eggs in one Pakistani basket have again done so, and they are comforting themselves and mitigating all of the aspersions that have been cast upon Mr. Zardari by saying that he has learned many a lessons while being in jail and while living under the dictatorship of Mr. Musharraf. I think it's very unlikely that, in fact, he's learned any of those lessons.
Hmm. So how did he get to where he is? Why is he president?
Well, this is one of those things that had I been given a gaming scenario a year ago at one of those Beltway bandit think tanks, I would have laughed it off as untenable and impossible. But a number of events transpired. The United States hadn't been particularly concerned about democracy in Pakistan. It had subordinated virtually all goals to the counterterrorism goals. It even, not made a significant peep when it became clear that AQ Khan had proliferated his way across the Middle East. And as long as Musharraf still cooperated, all was well.
Mm-hmm.
Democracy, like nonproliferation, really became subordinate to the goal of counterterrorism. Until about March 2007, when even Washington had to really rethink its Musharraf-only strategy, when a series of missteps had really galvanized in an unprecedented way Pakistan's civil society, first led by the lawyers' movement, but it began to generate momentum. And the demands for Musharraf to step down really became difficult for Washington to ignore. And since the stability of the country was imperiled, Washington thought it was prudent to switch course. It had really written off Nawaz Sharif. It believed him to be an Islamist. It had a number of beliefs about Nawaz Sharif that really weren't informed by an accurate reading of history. And Benazir Bhutto, in part because she was a woman, in part because she was saying the right thing, and unlike Nawaz Sharif, was courting, very actively Washington. Basically, the U.S. and the U.K. government sort of decided that what they would try to do is arrange a power-sharing agreement whereby Musharraf would step down as chief of army staff, hold elections, and basically launder his, dented credibility through the electoral process and Benazir Bhutto's electoral credibility. And essentially, he would stay on as president, and if she could muster the votes, as prime minister. And you saw in the after he had stepped down, Musharraf as chief army staff in November, he began putting into place a series of mechanisms that were going to result in a seriously rigged election. All of those efforts to rig the elections were really blown out of the water, literally, when Benazir was assassinated.
Mm-hmm.
Polling has shown that most Pakistanis believe that Musharraf or his supporters had something to do with her death. I don't hold that view, but that really put into jeopardy Musharraf's plans to sustain himself in power. The elections came in. The Pakistani army basically demurred from rigging on the day of the election. While that election wasn't entirely free and fair, it was free and fair enough. Pakistanis voted very clearly against Musharraf and his allies and put into place the PPP, which after she had died was under the leadership of her husband Zardari. And you know, you just saw a series of political machination that Zardari cleverly orchestrated. The thing, the pivotal step, of course, was that they were able to, through threat of impeachment, get Musharraf to resign, and that opened, of course, the path for him to become president. Very mm-hmm. masterful set of moves on his part.
Interesting. Now, the press reports say that he's seen in Pakistan as pro-American and has been welcomed by the Bush administration for his support of the campaign against terrorism. What is the campaign against terrorism in that part of the world, and how is he seen as supporting it?
Well, the short answer, of course, is that it is a joke. And everyone should understand that in Pakistan, unless the president is the chief of army staff, which it was under Musharraf, the president nor the prime minister doesn't hold these portfolios. The prime minister and the president cannot make the chief of army staff engage in robust counterinsurgency operations. So my reading of this is that what Zardari has done, Zardari has basically picked up all of the Musharraf speeches from 2004. He's saying all the right things, that I'm your man, I'm going to fight this terrorism menace. And I think what we can actually expect from him, like Musharraf, is actually very little. The reasons for this are not simply Pakistani perfidy, as it's often simplistically reduced to. It's a mixture of things, namely that the Pakistan army actually lacks the capability of decisively and successfully defeating these militants that are ensconced in the tribal areas, but also in other areas outside of the tribal areas. And it's in part due to the fact that the Pakistani strategic elite still view some militants as good and as viable means to project their security interests in Afghanistan, domestically within Pakistan, and of course in India and in Kashmir, while others it has tried to declare as terrorist organizations. The problem with this is that these groups, especially those that are Deobandi in their ideology, have always had overlapping membership. So it's actually quite difficult to declare one group a good militant organization that serves the cause of Pakistan and the other a terrorist organization that should be liquidated because of the fact that they share members, leadership, and other structural considerations.
Mm-hmm. So tell me about these missiles from the American pilotless drone that yesterday hit a compound in northern Pakistan belonging to one of Pakistan's most prominent Taliban leaders.
Haqqani.
Tell me about him and tell me about this attack, which evidently killed some children and injured a number of people who, from the press reports, are not militants.
Well, here's the big picture. We, the United States government, have been launching a number of these attacks in what's called the federally administered tribal areas. It has been known for years that it's known by the acronym FATA, that al-Qaeda and senior Taliban leadership, as well as a raft of militant groups that support both of those, such as the Tehrik-e-Taliban of Pakistan, which is the Pakistani Taliban, as well as dozens of other militant groups. It's like the Lollapalooza of terrorism, FATA is. And the Pakistani army has proven itself to be incapable. The Frontier Corps actively facilitates these militants, which is the paramilitary organization charged with security duties there. And there, we simply can't notify the Pakistanis of these attacks because what has become increasingly clear, and there have been leaks to this effect, is that they've been warning the Taliban before these attacks so that they can abscond and avoid being hit. So what you've seen the U.S. do out of sheer frustration is unilaterally bomb high-value targets in Fatah. Now, the problem with this, there are a number of problems with this. You know, I worked in Afghanistan with UNAMA. My brothers are in the Army. You know, I understand that when you have information about high-value targets, and these guys are not insignificant threats. These guys are actively planning to hurt the United States and its allies at home and abroad. So there is a real and present danger from Fatah, and that's why they're doing these unilateral strikes. There are at least three major problems with them. By the time the bombs hit their targets, many of the intended targets have long absconded. It has been rarely the case that these strikes actually get the fellows that we're trying to get, in this case, Haqqani. Haqqani, he's known to be in Waziristan. We've tried to get him, you know, we failed. Zawahiri and Bajor, we've targeted him a number of times, and we failed. And the way these fellows are ensconced in actual homes, and, you know, Pashtun homes, like many homes in rural areas in Pakistan, they tend to be compound homes or many families living there, women and children. So you just can't dump a bunch of ordnance on a house and just kill the bad guy. You're going to get their family members. Now, since there can be no media in Fatah, Pakistanis won't allow it. It's pretty much our word against the word of the Taliban. And, you know, how we can then verify who actually was killed without boots on the ground is very difficult. So we lose the war of perception, you know, as soon as we bomb this stuff. And it's very difficult to sustain these kinds of operations without incurring. Every Pakistani hates us virtually. I mean, for there to have more anti-American sentiment, you have to have new Pakistanis born. And since there are Pakistanis born every day, you can have more anti-American sentiment. It is impossible to understate the way in which these attacks undermine other U.S. interests in the country. And it underscores the fact that this administration has not developed ever a Pakistan strategy that prosecutes all of our security interests in that country simultaneously. So this is a recipe for disaster. Absolutely a recipe.
And yet, if these people are as horrible as you say they are and really want to do us harm, how do you get rid of them?
Well, see, this is the problem. We don't have a strategy to make Pakistan do that which it does not want to do. Now, I will say this. Haqqani, you know, Haqqani was also our former ally. You know, history does come around to bite one in unpleasant places. You know, during the Mujahideen period, Haqqani and another very bad guy, Hikmet TR, these were allies that received substantial funding from the United States to undermine the Soviets. So these, you know, many of the characters that were on our most favorite Mujahideen hit list, in terms of, you know, receiving support from us, are now on our enemy list. And there have been some reports that the Pakistanis have brokered U.S. negotiation efforts between Haqqani and Hikmet PR, but they're pretty much unreconcilable. From the Pakistanis' point of view, one day the international community is going to leave Afghanistan. They see the Indians all over Afghanistan. They see Kabul much more positively inclined toward Delhi than Islamabad. And Pakistan doesn't want to let go of these assets. So what you find are several high-value Taliban leadership that still enjoy protection from the Pakistanis. And, you know, Kiani himself said, Kiani meaning the chief of army staff, said that Haqqani is an important asset for Pakistan. So you have this very bizarre situation where we've paid the Pakistanis some $13 billion or more at this point to prosecute the war on terror while it is actively protecting our enemies. And this is something that's extraordinary. But it's also not unprecedented. Pakistan has long pursued its own interests while taking funding from the United States in the name of our security interests. In this case, it's the war on terrorism.
And when you said, I missed this, when you said earlier that these communities are being alerted to potential attacks, who's spilling the beans?
Well, that's another interesting story. I mean, I've been around this Pakistan block now for decades. I just can't seem to navigate my way off that block. So these rumors, in fact, you know, when I worked at UNAMA in Kabul, I would interact frequently with American and foreign military personnel. And it was very well known that when there was going to be an operation, that the ISI would alert the Taliban. And we knew of this. In some cases, they would justify it as a means so that the civilians get out of the way. But you never found anyone that would go on the record to say so publicly. A few weeks back, there was a CIA leak to this effect that was explosive. It occurred during Gilani's visit, and it was incredibly awkward, as you might imagine, having the new Pakistani prime minister, weak and effective as he is, coming to Washington amidst these reports that not only is the ISI alerting the Taliban and associated militants of these attacks, but also that the ISI was involved in the Indian embassy attack in Kabul. And I can tell you, U.S. government agencies they're incredibly frustrated with this double game. Now, what makes it so difficult to understand who is being played by whom is the fact that Pakistan has lost around, the number obviously increases, with great frequency. It's lost around 1,800 troops, and they are engaged in operations, and they are killing terrorists. They are deployed in Fatah, and they are taking fire, and they're returning fire. So it's not as if the Pakistanis are doing nothing.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that the Pakistanis want to moderate militancy. They don't want to eliminate it. And this means that some militants are protected while other militants are hunted down and killed. It also means that because the Pakistanis are a large conventional army ill-suited for counterinsurgency, that they do it very well. So they'll throw a bunch of frontier corps at the problem. The frontier corps will prove to be ineffective, and then the Pakistan army will come in, and they'll use very lethal air power that's indiscriminate and kills loads of women and children, which further alienates the public, who is frustrated with us and is frustrated with Islamabad, and it fuels this larger problem of terrorism that basically is just permeated across Pakistan, and obviously it's been entrenched in Afghanistan for years now.
Is there any way to moderate militancy? We'll ask Christine Fair in a moment, and welcome your phone calls. What a maze, huh? Professor Christine Fair is senior political scientist at the RAND Corporation. We're talking about the new president of Pakistan. We're talking about the attacks on Taliban compounds in northern Pakistan, and welcoming your calls. Here's our phone number. It's 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email, you can do that. That is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. We'll start your phone calls as soon as you'd like to call. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, what questions does Governor Sarah Palin need to answer? What would you like to know about the vice presidential candidate? And why is there so much media bashing? It's nothing new, but it was used to great extent at the Republican National Convention. It's also been used by Democrats, but we saw it on full display last week. Why does that play? And we'll talk with Bob McChesney about all of that, the media and whether or not it works to bash the media. So that's coming up after 10 o'clock today. Welcome to your phone calls as we talk about what's going on in Pakistan. And the picture isn't very pretty. Professor Christine Fair, senior political scientist at the RAND Corporation, is our guest. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, you can do that, and that is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Professor Fair, when you talked about moderating militancy as being a goal among some, how in the world do you moderate militancy?
Well, that's the absurdity of it. You don't. And one of the things that I have found consistently frustrating over the years is that, the United States pretty much accepted or at least tacitly acknowledged the way in which Pakistan chose to segment the militant market. For example, what we really sought from them in the initial years was focus upon al-Qaeda. We didn't really press them on the Taliban, at least in part because we thought the Taliban had been defeated and that major military operations in Afghanistan had ended. We were in for a very rude surprise in 2005 when the Taliban came back, raring for a fight, and we have been embroiled in an an ever-deteriorating insurgency in Afghanistan since 2005. It was at that point when we began at last putting pressure on the Pakistanis in 2005. But they were really not pressed on the Taliban at all. And in fact, whenever you would hear the much-touted, body count that President Bush would praise Musharraf for, never amongst them or in any of the high-value arrests were there any significant Taliban leadership worth mentioning. So, in other words, the Taliban were completely tolerated in 2005. We've continued to tolerate the so-called Kashmiri groups. We've never, with the exception of a brief period in late 2001 and in the spring of 2002, when militant groups attacked first the Indian Parliament in December and then a women and children's domicile, tied to the Indian Army in May, the so-called Kaluchuk massacre, we really didn't put much pressure on them to close down the so-called Kashmiri camps. And again, when we had the big earthquake in 2005, it was laid bare just how many of these militants are up there, because they were actually the first responders. And the problem with this approach is that apart from the fact that they've had overlapping membership, you really can't, tweeze them out with any precision or clarity. The problem is that many of these so-called Kashmir groups have hosted international terrorists. So, for example, Tanveer Ahmed, who was involved in the London bombing, he went and he met with Jaish-e-Mohammed officials. Mm-hmm. They were involved in targeting the church in Islamabad, among others. And he went to Fatah to film his martyrdom tape. So this idea that you can moderate militancy, that you can kill some while allowing others to thrive and flourish, is folly. It's absolute folly. And it's folly that the United States has actually encouraged this sort of approach on the part of the Pakistanis while paying them $13 billion since 2001 to fight the war on terrorism. It's unimaginable.
Hmm. Let's go to phone calls. Our number, 800-486-8655. Tim from Madison is our first caller. Christine, hi, Tim.
Hi, good morning. It's very interesting. I wonder, in a perfect world, what would the U.S. role be in Pakistan, and what would be, for instance, the different approaches each of the presidential candidates you think they would take?
Well, to be honest with you, this is my personal view, and obviously not that of my institution. We don't have a lot of good choices at this juncture. Many windows were closed. The Pakistanis looked at some of the things that we did in Afghanistan early on. Like, for example, we had a very light footprint. We never replaced it with the right footprint. We outsourced the war to warlords because that was going to be a cheap and dirty peace following a cheap and dirty war. We were not committed to nation building. This conditioned, and I cannot say adequately enough, the way the Pakistanis viewed what kind of future Afghanistan was going to shape up. It's going to be very difficult to put this toothpaste back into the tube because so much has gone on. We had an opportunity to really tell Pakistan, this is a new world order. The world is not going to change borders through the use of militancy. Disputes cannot be resolved through terrorism. We missed that opportunity. My only hope is that we will be able to use this presidential election as another, albeit far less cataclysmic, window of opportunity to say whatever deal Musharraf and Bush struck is not the new deal that's going to go forward. And if we fail to do that, then I don't even want to think about what kind of region we're going to confront. But it's very clear that Pakistan must be told that no militant is a good militant. The only good militant is a militant that's been arrested or otherwise eliminated. We also need, and the way I phrase that, I didn't say the only militant that's good is a dead militant. This idea that that these are not criminals that can be, that these are people who should not be dealt with through a law and order process, I think has been to our detriment as well as theirs. Pakistanis have to feel that justice has been done. And simply, targeting people who are alleged to be terrorists does not present the opportunity for Pakistanis to understand that these are not simply individuals who threaten us, but who threaten them. It doesn't present the opportunity to present evidence against the individuals. So it's really important that we convince the Pakistanis that militancy cannot be accepted and won't be accepted, and that there'll be penalties for supporting militancy, and that the militants have to be dealt with in an appropriate law and order framework. Second, we have at our disposal both, you know, American bilateral options, and there are also multilateral options. The UN Security Council, albeit we'll have to get China on board, is certainly a venue where explicit language could be constructed about states who support terrorist groups. So far, even the issue of how one defines the Taliban has been very narrowly threaded so that Pakistan cannot be censored. I mean, at some point, if we take this threat seriously, we need to actually be serious about that threat. I think the other thing that we really need to do is that we can't put pressure on Pakistan while being completely dependent upon it. Right now, 90% of our logistics for the war effort flow through Karachi. I always tell people you can't keep bombing things in Fatah before the Pakistanis cut us off from the port. In fact, there were discussions of precisely that last week in Islamabad. So if we're going to be increasingly hardball with Pakistan, we need to diminish our vulnerability to the amenities that Pakistan affords. It'd be quite ironic that if in the process of bombing things to support the war in Afghanistan, we actually get cut off from our only logistical supply. It also means that the U.S. has to do what it doesn't want to do, and that is it needs to have repaired relations with all of Afghanistan's neighbors. If we didn't have an insane set of policies towards Iran, we wouldn't have to be completely dependent upon Pakistan. Iran disliked the Taliban as much as we did, and they cooperated in bringing down the Taliban in the early months of the war. They were thanked for that with the Axis of Evil speech. Iran has two ports that provide ready access to Afghanistan. But, of course, our hostilities to Iran have really made that not possible. A northern fuel route has also been made difficult because of Russian intransigence and its recent invasion of Georgia and subsequent occupation. We've signed a fuel deal to get Russian fuel into Afghanistan. That's going to be very hard to actually operationalize. That being said, we really never followed through vigorously negotiations with Uzbekistan or Tajikistan. Instead, we have done what we've done since the beginning. We've put all of our eggs in the Pakistan basket. We've done absolutely no, well, we've done ourselves a disservice by not diversifying our options. So apart from putting on the table a willingness to play hardball with Pakistan, we also need to put onto the table meaningful resources that will help attract potential reformers. We do need partners in the Pakistani government. I'm going to tell you, I have very little confidence this will succeed because there are very few reformers in Pakistan right now. But we do need to be on the hunt. We need to find institutions that we can work with, and maybe because of the antipathy towards the United States, bilateral aid may not be the most effective. Maybe the UNDP, World Bank, ADB, maybe some of these multilateral baskets may be the best way, but we need to be focusing not on the military, but focusing on building up Pakistan's civilian capacity. These are all huge priorities that whoever becomes the president must take up with alacrity.
Mm-hmm. And is any of that going on right now, Christine, building up the civilian capacity?
No. I mean, absolutely no. Biden and Lugar have put into place some legislation that aims to do this, and I think the intention is in the right place. But the lesson of the last 7 years should be that large sums of money flowing without accountability, without mutually agreed upon benchmarks, review, and willingness to withhold money if those benchmarks aren't made, have made this, we've more than $13 billion, it's been a waste. Pakistan is less safe, it's more corrupt. The tangible benefits of those monies are not appreciated by anyone, certainly not us. What benefit have we seen for our hard-earned tax dollars going down the tubes? The Biden-Lugar legislation, it's a step in the right direction. I'm actually a fan of doing what the World Bank does, which is, and the IMF, Pakistan does not mess around with the World Bank and IMF like they do with us. We go in there, we say, here's our objectives, what can you do? The Pakistanis will say, we can't do that for the following reason. But we negotiate back and forth. We put into place a plan. We review the plan. And if the plan and the benchmarks aren't met, no money until remediation is made. You can't just throw money at a problem. You have to have buy-in. There has to be Pakistani resources. going into the same objective so that it's not all what I call supply-driven or donor-driven aid. And there's the literature on this is clear. Donor-driven aid never works. Never. As a fact.
Let's go to Dom from Wisconsin Rapids. Hi, Dom.
Yeah, hi, Kathleen. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, I usually don't want to call, but then you come up with some interesting topic. Well, I guess, you know, I respect the RAND Corporation because I guess I follow what they do, and they're one of the few institutions that does some very good research. Quick question on what's going on in the region. You know, we know that there's conflict in Kashmir, and that's being caused by the Pakistanis, and then their Indian embassy bombing in Kabul. And yet, you know, India should be is about the most responsible state in the region. So we keep pumping money into Pakistan, you know, even during Musharraf's regime, and now this guy is called Mr. 10%.
So well, he said he missed 30%.
Benazir Bhutto was prime minister. You know, he used to take a graft from every government, you know, contractor. And that's the news. And we still are censuring India for, you know, just, well, you're making these nuclear weapons. India has been the most responsible state. And then we are cozy with China on one side, Pakistan on the other side. Pretty soon we're going to be alienating India, the one neighbor that we need to be working more closely with. And I don't understand why with the politics of it. And we're shooting ourselves in the foot by doing that.
Well, I certainly appreciate your sentiment, but I don't think it's not that the opinion that you just espoused isn't terribly reflective of current developments. Since 2000, India and the United States have been undergoing an unprecedented rapprochement and strategic relationship. At the cornerstone of this strategic relationship has been extensive military-to-military ties. It may be easy to take a look at the F-16s that were, you know, foisting at Pakistan in hopes of buying their acquiescence to our global war on terrorism. But what's actually on offer to India is much more significant in scope. President Bush, and this actually was done under Vajpayee, but it's been continued under Manmohan Singh, the United States has pledged to help help India become a global power, even while it continues what's largely a tactical relationship in some sense with Pakistan.
Okay, but how come they're opposing their membership in the Security Council?
That's also not true. But the second point that I want to raise that's really important is the Indo-U.S. nuclear deal. President Bush has worked with the U.S. Congress to reverse decades of legislation to essentially create a regime of exceptionalism that would allow the United States and other countries to provide civilian assistance to India's nuclear program. The way the deal is structured, it's a very bomb-friendly deal. The Indians will be able to acquire in the global markets radioactive materials for their civilian program, allowing them to use their domestic resources for bomb production. There's no real... the legislation does suggest a cessation of assistance should India test, but it's not necessarily binding. So the U.S. nuclear deal with India is absolutely transformative. I actually think that the sentiment that you've espoused hasn't really kept up with the actual facts of the U.S.-Indian relationship. Everyone agrees that the long-term interests of India in the United States are much more consonant than the interests of the Pakistanis and the Americans. Now, I think there was a third point that you wanted to raise, and I forgot what that point was.
Well, actually, how come they haven't allowed India to become a permanent member of the
UN Security
Council?
UN Security Council reform. Actually, the United States, their view on the UN and the UN Security Council period is one of reform. The United States has been an advocate of reforming the UN and the UN Security Council. The United States has actually, the position, again, that you just espoused is a very old position. The United States has said that it would consider supporting India's bid, but that it wants to do so in the context of larger UN Security Council reform. Now, this is a little bit more complicated than simply admitting your friends into the UN Security Council because the U.S. doesn't have the unilateral right to do that. It requires international consensus. And there are a number of countries that have been responsible stewards of regional security in the region for far longer than India has. Namely, Japan would also like, and unlike India, Japan has you know, abided by the global non-proliferation regime. So there are a number of countries that view itself as being in the queue in front of India. And then let's also be a little bit clear about the Indian record. It was India that began the nuclear proliferation of South Asia. It was not Pakistan. It may have had interest in doing so, but it began its program long before Pakistan did. And India's record in Kashmir is certainly not pristine. India has a very well-documented record of appalling human rights abuses in Kashmir. I will say so has Pakistan. Both the use of Indian security forces and the use of Pakistan-backed militants in Kashmir has exacted a bloody toll on the varied populations in the areas of Jammu and Kashmir over the past several decades.
And thanks very much for the call. Can we spend just a couple moments here before we go back to phone calls talking about the resurgence of the Taliban and what allows them to gain strength? Is it intimidation, Christine? Is it that they're providing services for the populations? What is it? Why would people be attracted to that again?
Oh, well, you mean the Taliban in Afghanistan or the Taliban in Pakistan? Because now we have two Taliban.
Both.
Well, in the case of Afghanistan, you know, Afghans, you know, three decades of having war fought on your country makes you a little bit sober about who you're going to support and why.
Mm-hmm.
The Afghans in the South are going to be very loath to throw their support behind the international community allied with the Afghan government when they don't believe that we can actually win. So the Taliban don't have to buy support. All they have to do is through, you know, basically coercion and violence, can deter support for the Afghan government and its international partners. And that appears to be the case. The other important issue is absolute massive corruption of the Afghan government. Everyone loves to blame Pakistan for the failures, but the fact is the Afghan government is abjectly corrupt. And we, the international community, have really not paid adequate attention to this fact. The average Afghan, the only thing they're going to see from the government is probably the police. And the police are the worst. They are just absolute predators. And everyone knows that the Afghan government and many of its functionaries are involved in various aspects of the narcotics trade. It's not just the Taliban. Governors and police chiefs are all involved.
Mm-hmm.
The Afghan government, it's a narcotic state because the elites are vested in it being so.
Mm-hmm.
And so for many Afghans, I remember when I worked in Kabul, I had a chance to travel around the country. I never met anyone who had anything positive to say about the Karzai government except the people who work for him. And they all said remarkably similar things. They said, look, the Taliban were scoundrels, they were violent, they were killers, they were ruthless, but we didn't have to worry about being robbed, we didn't have to worry about our daughters and sons being raped, and we didn't have to worry about the police, you know, bribing us. The roads were safe, we could move around safely. So there may have been, justice may have been brutal, it may have been expedient, it may have not been procedural or equitable, but there was security, and many Afghans do hearken to that past. So it's a combination of lack of legitimacy, corruption, and the lack of security, coupled with the increasing belief that the international community can't prevail, that's allowing the Taliban to establish strongholds, not only consolidating their positions in the south and the east, which have been historical positions, but even pockets up in the north where it's almost unimaginable that the Taliban could develop a presence, but sure enough, they have.
We're talking this hour with Christine Fair, senior political scientist at the RAND Corporation, and we're talking about all that's been going on in Pakistan. New president has been elected, although there is some question about his honesty. He spent months in jail on corruption charges and is known as a 10% or 20 or 30% guy taking money now. And we're looking at the drones that have hit compounds in northern Pakistan. Not just one of these, but several have been going on. The relationship between the Pakistani government and the Taliban and Afghanistan, and the very messy situation in that part of the world. So here's our number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We have an interesting email up that we'll get to in a moment as well. Professor Christine Fair is Senior Political Scientist at the RAND Corporation. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program, we'll talk about media bashing and also ask you what your thoughts are about the vice presidential candidate on the Republican side not meeting the press and what questions you think she needs to answer. All right, here's an email for Professor Christine Fair, senior political scientist at the RAND Corporation. The U.S. by its action is increasingly alienating the entire Pakistani population by the jackboot tactics it's employing in the agency areas. The attacks by drones have been going on for over a year with several hundred innocent women and children killed. Last week, the first time the U.S. troops crossed the border, according to the press reports, killed women and children. Naturally, the country doesn't like this. Second, as the U.S. is seen as meddling into Pakistani domestic affairs, its role is resented. The Benazir saga was a non-starter. Musharraf was ousted by democratic means. And now the U.S. support for Zardari is misplaced because it will have little popular support. This is what is likely to happen. The secular U.S. stooges will be overthrown and the mullahs will be ushered in a la Iran in the 1970s. And then the nuclear option looms very large.
Well, he had me, or she had me, until the latter until the latter suppositions. I agree with everything that the listener has written. With the where he or she loses me is actually in the argument that the secular stooges will be trounced, the Islamist barbarians are going to bang down the gate and run off with the nukes. It's a little bit more subtle than that. I mean, more so than the fear of Islamism in Pakistan, what our biggest problem is anti-Americanism. There is what I call a fake binary. People assume that if you're so-called secular or oppose political Islam, that you must be pro-American. People also assume that if you're an Islamist or a political Islamist, that you would necessarily reject Zardari and you would support terrorism. These are all fake binaries. In Pakistan, it is completely possible for an individual to be alienated by the political Islamists, by the militants, by the military, by the political class, and by the Americans. And in fact, I would argue that the average Pakistani is in fact alienated by a majority, if not all of those segments of the Pakistani elite that I've mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the biggest problem. Zardari, more so than for him being purportedly secular, I will add that all of the political parties, the PPP and obviously the PMLN, they've all made deals with Islamist parties. I take great exception to the characterization of the PPP as secular. Their track record shows a different set of realities. I always like to remind people that the Taliban came to being, and the policy of Pakistan supporting the Taliban came to being under Benazir Bhutto. This was a Bhutto policy. Her Afghan advisor devised the Afghan policy of her father. So, you know, this idea that PPP is secular and everyone else is not doesn't really hold water. He will certainly be undone, not because he's secular, but because he's corrupt and because he's not going to be able to govern. Because everything that he said thus far has been targeting the U.S. audience. The Pakistanis don't care about the war on terror. They care about the fact that they're having an economic crisis and there's a food shortage, and he's doing nothing to a power shortage.
Mm-hmm.
He's doing nothing to address that. So he will certainly be undone, but not because he's a secular stooge, because I don't see him as a secular stooge. He's self-serving. He's nobody's stooge except his own.
Interesting. Yeah.
And the Islamist nuke thing has also been massively overblown. It's not possible. It's just not possible. Pakistan doesn't have a clerical elite like Iran did. So the Khomeini scenario, everything's possible, I suppose, but it's highly improbable. And that's not where our policy focus should be, is running off the nuclear-armed Islamist boogeyman. We have much bigger
right.
problems than that.
What's he doing with all the money, Christine?
Who knows? I mean, there have been different efforts. I remember during the caretaker government of Farooq Lagari, a number of politicians were listed who hadn't paid taxes. mean, there have been these regular lists of efforts to bring these political scoundrels. Actually, Musharraf did the same thing under the National Accountability Bureau. The head of that NAB, it was called NAB, a great name, was doing his job with due diligence until he reported to Musharraf that at some point, you know, some of these generals are pretty corrupt, too. So corruption is absolutely rife in the political system. Civilian and military leaders alike are what are they doing with it? They are basically doling out patronage. They're doling out lucrative contracts to their supporters. Obviously, you know, one doesn't get the name Mr. 10%, likely without taking at least 5%. what we've seen in the Pakistani political system is that virtually every single civilian leader, as well as military leader, has you know, they've used their position of influence and power to benefit their support base. And the support base is usually not national. That's the problem with patronage politics, is that it doesn't help out people throughout the country. Usually patronage is concentrated among particular ethnic groups, families, or, you know, in the case of Nawaz Sharif, industrial classes, in the case of the PPP, the feudal elites. It's a highly inequitable way of distributing resources to one's supporters.
Let's go to Gary from Milwaukee. Hi, Gary.
Hi, how you doing? Okay, I just got a question, and I'll take it off the air. I'm just wondering, where is the Taliban getting their arms from? What country are they made in? Where are they coming from? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay.
That is a brilliant question. And I have to say, I've asked the same question myself. They are incredibly well-armed. The Pakistani Taliban are much better armed than the Pakistani army. I wish that we could focus as much effort on weapons interdiction as we do on narcotics interdiction, because this is the real question. It's not clear where they're getting their weapons. In some cases, there's pilferage from the U.S. Army, the U.S. NATO materiel that's moving from Karachi into Afghanistan. Obviously, the Iranians are supplying weapons. The Pakistanis are certainly supplying the Taliban. But where they're getting their high-value weapons is an excellent question, and I have not seen any excellent answers. But you've really nailed this problem on the head. And it's not just the weapons. They're getting military-grade explosives that they're using in their suicide bombing vests. It's the best question, and there are no good answers.
Hmm. I know you have a meeting to go to, so we're going to let you leave a little bit earlier. Thank you so much for your expertise. You know so much about this part of the world.
Oh, you flatter me. You're so kind. Thank you always for having me. I just love doing your show. Your listeners always ask the good questions.
They do. Thank you, Christine.
Thank you.
Professor Christine Fair, senior political scientist at the RAND Corporation, talking about all of the news from Pakistan, and there is much of it in the last week. Asif Ali Zardari, widower of the slain former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto, has been elected president, has little experience in governing, and he has also spent 11 months in jail on corruption charges that were not proven. He succeeds. Remember when we were talking about Pervez Musharraf? He resigned last month under threat of impeachment. And we are hearing from press reports that he is seen in Pakistan as pro-American and has been welcomed by the Bush administration for his support of the campaign against terrorism. Christine also responding to the missiles from the American pilotless drone aircraft yesterday hitting a large compound in northern Pakistan belonging to one of the Pakistan's most prominent Taliban leaders. And the strike singled out the compound run by Haqqani, whom the United States has accused of organizing some of the most recent attacks in Afghanistan against American and NATO forces, and of masterminding the assassination attempt against the Afghan president Hamid Karzai. So this goes on. It looks like it's such a maze. It's hard to figure out how to build nations that are peaceful, doesn't it? We thank her so much for her expertise. She's always a wonderful guest. And we will continue. We want to thank Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and also John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. We will continue our Tuesday conversation by talking about Sarah Palin and how much we know about her and what questions you would like to ask her and the media bashing that took place at the Republican National Convention. There, of course, was some of that bashing among Hillary campaign staff back in the primary. But what is this long history of bashing the press? It seems as though the press has a job to do and you want to find out about somebody who's running for office. So we'll ask you, you may want to think about this right now, about the questions that you think Sarah Palin needs to answer. If you would like to have her on certain programs and what those programs would be if she needs to step behind the microphone and just sit down for a chat so we have a better understanding of who this is. Or do you think the press is hounding her by asking her to appear before the press? So we will talk about all of that the second hour of our program today and welcome your phone calls. Our lines here are always 800-486-8655. And this email is open to you as well. It's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. We'll tell you more about next hour's program in a moment. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.